You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't mind.
Joining us for the last time this year is Alex Hollings. Hey, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Mac.
Hey, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Mac. I'm glad to be here.
How was Christmas, man? Is there anything like watching the face of a little kid when they come around the corner and see the Christmas tree and all the presents?
You know, it's funny that you asked me that, because I was up very, very late Christmas Eve night, as all Santas are, right?
Right.
And, especially because I refinished an old toy box for her that we put a lot of the gifts in, so I was putting the final touches on that, because it's never perfect. Anytime I'm working on a project, I will continue to fiddle with it until the very last minute. And then she got me up, you know, 4 hours after I went to bed. And you wouldn't believe it, though. We came out into the living room, and she saw all the presents and was like, Santa? And I said, yeah. And she was like, okay, let's lay on the couch. And she legit just laid on the couch for an hour, just not wanting to be awake. She's definitely my daughter. She was like, I want to see that Santa came, but now let's just take a little time to we'll just lay here for a while, eat some breakfast, and for me, have 6 cups of coffee. So she's definitely my kid. But, man,
wow.
This was the first Christmas. She's two, so this is the first Christmas she really understood the premise of getting gifts or opening presents and stuff. It was really, really awesome. You know, and then we went and spent time with my family, too. So we got to go see my niece and nephew and my mom and stuff. So it was a great Christmas. How was yours?
Well, you know, Christmas is different when you get old, man. I mean, your kids, like half my our two oldest sons are gone, right? And we have a 26-year-old daughter. And we have a 16-year-old daughter. So, I mean, she's still a teenager, right? So there's still a little bit of it in the house. And we were lucky because, you know, when you have a kid late in life, you know, your other kids are teenagers. And so a lot of times the magic isn't there anymore. The merchandise is, which is
the
not...
The merchandise is definitely there.
Yeah, and that's the downs. That's not the good side of Christmas. The fun of Christmas is the magic of Christmas. So having, a little one 10 years, you know, in our with 10 years separation meant that the magic of Christmas was in the house for everybody. And so that was really cool. But now, I mean...
Very similar in my house. My younger brother's 11 years younger than my older brother, and 7 years younger than me.
Yeah, so everybody's got to be with the program.
Yeah, we got to keep Christmas alive well into my later teen years, you know?
And it's fun.
Yeah, it really is.
And it's fun. So, but now that they're, you know, like, my sons both live on the East Coast, and so they flew in the day after Christmas. And they spent Christmas with the other sides of their families and stuff like that, and then flew out. So Christmas is kind of ongoing now. As you get older, you know, your opportunities to have your family together don't come around very often. And so to have everybody in one spot, so we're doing that now. So which is the most wonderful, you know, experience. Parenting is, I think, the greatest experience in life. And as your kids get older and they grow up and they become good people, and they become dads and husbands, and there's no warmer feeling on the planet than to watch that, right?
And I can absolutely relate to that. You know, my younger brother lives out in L.A., and we went out there for his wedding a month or so ago, and it didn't occur to us until we were sitting around a table at his wedding that it was the first time all of the my dad passed, but all of the surviving members of our nuclear family had sat at a table in probably 10 years.
Wow.
You know, and through no real intention of ours, you know, and we've gotten together, you know what I mean? Like, we've gone out there and seen him, you know, one part of the family, maybe my wife and I, or my brother and his wife, or my mom would go out, and vice versa. He'd come out, but I was gone. You know, so it's not that we haven't seen each other, but we hadn't all sat at the same table. We hadn't been in one place at the same time in a really, really long time. And it just kind of sneaks up on you. Like you're saying, the older you get, the easier it is to go a year without, you know what I mean?
Yeah, everybody's got their own
trip, you know?
Right. Yeah. So no, it's so I mean, it is cool because it doesn't, you know, being a family is being a family, and it's the same stupid stuff, and it's the same stupid jokes, and but it's eating the same food together, and the magic of being a family. So we're doing that now. So we opened presents day before yesterday, and that was awesome, and then we and had Christmas dinner. And we'll, I think the kids are cooking today, so that'll be an adventure. But, but my oldest son and his wife are straight up foodies, man. I say this with all seriousness, that anything my daughter-in-law cooks, I will stick in my mouth. Right? Even things that I've never historically.
Would normally not try,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. If she cooks it, I will, I mean, she's a great cook, so. And he's a foodie too, so, So that'll be fun, and then I'm not sure what's going on. At some point we're gonna play a wiffle ball game, which will be a very serious wiffle ball game. So that's important. But no, Christmas is different though. It's different because it's not the same. You have this image of, you know, what it is in your head, and then as you get older, it changes. So, and I like little kid Christmas. Right.
I love little kid Christmas. I told you last time. I love Christmas, and it's like you were saying. It's been a long time since we've had little kids around. My brother and I both had kids a little bit later than a lot of people. You know, my wife and I were 34 when my daughter was born. My older brother was also in his mid 30s when his son was born, and so you know we went through our full 20s and well into our 30s with no little kid Christmas in the family. You know. So Russ now is 4 years old. My daughter's 2 years old. So we're just now really getting to dive back into little kid Christmas, except for the Elf on the Shelf. I know we talked about it before. No Elf on the Shelf in my house. That's just not going to happen. But other than that, I love little kid Christmas.
Now, again, I'm going to give everybody great advice. If your kid doesn't know what no means by the time they're two, if they don't stop, you're going to have a problem for the rest of your life. You're going to pay for it.
And even if they do know what no means, you're still – because, you know, I heeded your advice, and I worked really hard to establish that when Dad says no, Dad means no.
Exactly.
You know? But I swear it really was like clockwork. The minute my daughter turned two, she discovered the power of the tantrum. And these past few weeks, she turned two at the end of November. These past few weeks have been very tantrum-filled weeks. You know, now instead of I put her to bed in her crib, which she could absolutely climb out of, but hasn't figured out yet. So I'm milking that for as long as I can. You know, but I'll lay her down in her crib and she just starts yelling, "Daddy, yuck, no bed, yuck." You know, and when I say, no, it's time for bed, and I leave, she proceeds to melt down. And I know you can relate to this even though it's been a while. You know, you sit outside the door, and you say, nope, it's time for bed. And she's yelling and screaming, and then she switches to whimpering. And it is like tearing your chest or tearing your heart out through your chest like Indiana Jones. It is brutal. I'm struggling with it, man.
No. Again, it's a lifetime investment because if you don't get it done at that age, you will pay for it every day for the rest of your life. And if you do get it done at that age where you can take them anywhere and they have good manners and they understand when you look at them and say, don't do that, they stop doing it, then to me, you will enjoy your kids so much because you'll do so much with them.
Exactly. And, then you won't feel as though you can't take them out to dinner. Well, and you won't feel as though you can't go on that trip.
Because you can. You know? And people walk up to you and say, how do you do that? Say, that's not easy, man. But if you stay on it, if you're consistent, if you send the same message, kids learn. They learn. No means no. And he doesn't give in. And so, but it's, again, it's, you know, it's the timeless lessons of parenting, in my opinion. But I will tell you this, ultimately it's a selfish act because you will enjoy your family more if you can install it. If you can't install it, then you're going to pay every day, every meal, every time they go to bed. It's just, I watch people that live like that and I'm like, damn.
I honestly see how easy it is to fall into that trap because I'm constantly vigilant. I'm always worried about how I'm raising Reagan now and how she's going to turn out, which is probably not really – it shouldn't be that present a concern for me when she's 2 years old. But I'm always worried about the lessons that I'm instilling, you know. But at the same time, she's, you know, she's your blood. She's the most precious thing in the world to me. And, I mean, any other parents out there, I'm sure you can relate to when you know you have to be stern, but, like, it's the last thing in the world that you want to be,
right.
You know. And it is an ongoing struggle because there's definitely times where I fold and I go, no means no. And then 10 minutes later, she doesn't remember why she's upset. She's just still upset. And we're sitting on the couch and I'm like, hey, don't tell mom, but you want a cookie? And she goes, yeah, cookie. And then I go back to being the favorite, you know. So, right. Like, right, it definitely happens.
No, you know, I used to make, after I get mad at them and they get in trouble, I would make them, I would make them come sit next to me on the couch.
So that's what I do too. Yeah, because I want her to know I have a short memory. I'm not angry at you.
Yeah, I'm like a I'm like a cornerback on a football team that just got smoked. Okay, I'm out here again, but come back and then I make him say, "Who loves you the most in the world? You do. Okay, give me a kiss. All right. Now don't make me mad anymore. Get out of here." When they take off running.
In all honesty, in a weird way, that's a lesson that I learned in the Marine Corps.
Well,
you know, when I was a leader of Marines, I learned very quickly that you have to have a short memory. When one of your Marines screws up, you can't hold it against them for the rest of forever. You know, even if it's a pretty good screw up, you know, even when you get a call at 1 o'clock in the morning because this dumb asshole was drinking outside the base theater underage, you know, and you've got to go deal with that. The next day, you know, you've got to go ahead and make sure the discipline is instilled, but you still need to reestablish that team fabric. You still need to carry on and complete whatever the mission of the day is, and it doesn't matter that he screwed up yesterday. We're going to deal with that. We're going to manage it, but you have to have a short memory. You can't hold, like, an emotional grudge for the rest of the day or the week just because somebody did something that pisses you off. The Marine Corps showed me the value of that, and as a dad, I'm cognizant of it. Whenever I am yelling at
honestly,
her, I always try my best to be like, this is not about you being a good or bad kid. This is just about you can't do this thing. You know?
It's the same skill. It's the parenting thing. It's the exact same skill, whether you're doing it with Marines or doing it with a little kid. And what you're trying to do with Marines is to instill in them, look, you can overcome these stupid things, okay? The rail that you don't want to touch, though, is don't lie about it. All right?
Yes.
I can move mountains for you, but if you piss down my back and tell me it's raining, right, you'll pay for that. And I'll make you pay for that. Because don't do that. It's not a way to live your life, okay? Everybody makes mistakes. Sometimes we make really stupid ones, okay? And even I do it. Okay? Own it and overcome it. And that's to me.
We've got to be on the same team. Right.
As long as you're within the left and right lateral limit, you know, I'll be your number one fan. I'll be the person who fights. But your protection money is your honesty. When you don't pay your protection money, you have what happens to people that don't pay their protection money. You don't get protected.
And so, you know, my parents very much, you know, there's plenty of faults I could give my parents, but they really did instill that mentality in me. I distinctly recall coming into my parents' bedroom in the middle of the night, my senior year in high school, after we were out doing dumb stuff. And waking my mom up and being like, Mom, listen, there's a chance that the police are going to come asking about me tonight. So I want you to hear it first. So the police did not end up coming, but I was like, but I want you to hear this dumb shit my friends and I were doing first. So that way, whatever it is that they tell you, you'll know what really happened. You know, and my mom got up, came out into the living room, made herself a cup of coffee and was like, all right, let's talk, you know. And of course, it was a senior prank, you know, one of those kind of dumb things. The statute of limitations, Lord knows I'm so old, is up. But, you know, we just went around and did dumb graffiti type stuff all around the school. Not like spray paint, but, you know, just dumb stuff. And, but I was like, just so you know, the cops will probably be interested in who covered, you know, the centerpiece in the courtyard with sauerkraut and fish heads and stuff like that. So if they come here, you should know, yeah, that was us. But we're good kids, I swear. You know? And my mom, I tell you what, though, my mom was every bit that parent. Your fear when you're the kid that she's going to freak out on you for what you did wrong, which you obviously did wrong. And instead my mom was like, well, that was stupid, wasn't it? And I was like, well, you know, it was also hilarious, she, you know. But my mom actually, to her credit, this is something she said to me a lot growing up. I moved schools a lot. We moved around a lot. And I was perpetually the new kid. And my mom would always say, well, fuck them if they can't take a joke. You know, and that carried me far. You know, it really did. She was very serious about things that needed to be serious. But if it wasn't really in the big picture that serious a deal, my mom was always cool. You know, she was like, you're grounded for 2 weeks. That was stupid. Come on, man. You know, she treated me like a peer in a way that a lot of adults don't, you know. And I think I turned out better for it. You know?
No, I tell people, I think that there's an age, and all kids are different, but, you know, early teens, you know, somewhere between, you know, 11 and 18, you know, pick a number, and they will define the number, but where you have to change your parenting style. When they're young, they don't have the brain developed to make sound decisions. That's why I find this whole thing, well, you're going to decide. And if you make a bad decision, I mean, kids don't understand that. I mean, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, you can teach that in small doses, but you're there as a parent to give structure to something that doesn't have structure and doesn't have the maturity to make informed decisions, right? All I don't want to do is eat these vegetables, and I will bend steel to do that. Okay?
Absolutely. And there's no worry about tomorrow.
Yeah, the consequence? Whatever, man. I'll deal with that. I'll break you in half for that, too, later. I'm just dealing with this right now. And so, as a parent, you're supposed to, and what you're, in my opinion, what you're doing is you're really building infrastructure in children about how, what's important, how to live, how to treat other people, blah, 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 blah. And then there comes a point when you recognize in them a glimmer. It's like when Edison threw the first light switch and the filament kind of like went, wah. You begin to see that percolating in their eyes and hear it coming out of their mouth. And you as a parent, you switch gears and they're going to look at you and say, you're not going to get mad at me for that. And you look and say, hey, look, you know right from wrong, right? I'm not going to get mad, but you're going to pay for it. You know,
exactly.
And these
my
are the consequences. And you're like, whoa.
I'm not grounding you. You grounded you.
Yeah.
It was your behavior that got you landed here.
Right. And so I think that's important where you begin to transition the way you parent and treat them like a peer. And I believe that the reason you try to do that, and it doesn't always work, is that so that when they face greater problems in the future of their life, they don't have this, like, he or she is really going to get pissed at me. What they have is, yeah, they're going to be a little bit disappointed, but you know what? They're going to give me great advice, and they'll fight for me, and I know that. You've got to lay the foundation for that someplace. And to me, it's in their teenage years, by the way you parent. So that hopefully, you know, when somebody does get pregnant or, you know, when they face some other, maybe dropping out of college or some other life-altering event,
be no doubt that that'll happen.
Right. That they might come and say, hey, could I talk to you? I need some help. I need some advice.
You know, because the sky falls for every teenager at least once.
Oh,
you know what I mean? And if your teenager doesn't feel as though they can come and talk to you, they're not going to come and talk to you. You know, I can say that from personal experience. You know, I had a very good relationship with my mom. I couldn't really talk to my dad about much, you know. My older brother was a little different. He was closer with my dad, not so close with my mom. But when I got into trouble, I definitely wasn't going to go tell my dad. Because my worst fear was that my dad would find out. You know what I mean? So it really is true. You have to find that balance. And obviously, I've got my work cut out for me to try to establish that
balance. And again, I think there's what's great about two-parent families is there is that, you know, that chi and che. And that's why single parent families are so hard, because one person's got to be both those people. I think.
And, you know, and the Marine Corps will teach you that too. There's a reason why there's a kill hat and a senior drill instructor in every platoon at boot camp. You know, there has to be, we called it the daddy, but it could very feasibly be the mommy. There has to be someone that you feel like you can run and tell whatever's going on to. And there's got to be someone that's the real strict disciplinarian. When I say has to, that's not the right word. Things are easier
right
when you have those two roles in the house. And they don't even necessarily always have to be the same roles. My wife and I have differing blind spots when it comes to being able to be stern. You know, my wife just cannot handle it when my daughter cries. And because of that, my daughter knows that if she can just keep crying for long enough, my wife will fold, you know. And so she tries that same method with me. It usually doesn't work because – especially when she's fake crying. I mean, you can tell when she's faking it, you know? And I'll just sit there right across from her looking at her going, Bean, I know you're faking it.
Really? Are we really going to do this? Come on.
Yeah, are we going to play this game? Come on now. You know?
You want to see Daddy cry?
I do that. I absolutely do.
Come on, how do you not? If you don't create comedy out of it, it's just ridiculous. That's why it's the most fascinating thing that you do. And it's not like it ends, you know. You parent for a lifetime.
Ask my mom. My mom gave me this rad Star Trek communicator badge that's sitting on my desk right now for Christmas.
Get out.
It's Bluetooth enabled. I can put it on my shirt and tap it to talk to you on the phone.
Please
don't. If you want to talk later.
Please don't. All right. You're gonna scare people. But no, I mean from watching them, you know, learn how to shake hands and learn how to squeeze somebody's hand and learn how to look them in the eye when they say shake hands, to coaching them into, okay, when they say it's nice to meet you, don't say nice to meet you, all right? Take a breath, right? Look at them and say, thank you, Mr. Gershman. It was a pleasure to have met you. And they will faint, okay, because kids don't say that shit, right? And then you see them do it out in public, and the adult stops and looks at them and says, who taught you that? And they start laughing like, my dad. And like, look, I interview kids all the time. That handshake you got and what you just said, if you keep doing that, John, you will get any job you want to. That is so impressive. Congratulations on being a well-mannered young man. And you're just like, you're walking back to the car with him, you're like, I told you, man, people love that shit.
Right?
Right? And you can get raises and jobs doing that kind of dumb stuff, man. And so, and you know, you watch them and then you see them, you know, become parents and stuff like that. So it's the coolest. It's the absolute coolest thing. I love it. But I do miss little kid Christmas. And so we had some of it, with my grandson around, so which is cool. So, I'll tell you, I got something that you need to watch. Somebody sent it to me this morning. It's on Hulu. It's called Gallagher Effect.
The Gallagher Effect. That sounds familiar.
Well,
the
guy puts together, he covered the Gallagher trial. So he was in the courtroom and he takes these,
I know exactly what you're talking about now.
He takes these interviews and videos, and he walks you through it. It's about 29 minutes long. I'll send you a link to it or the information to it, and you can, I don't know if you're a Hulu guy, but you can.
Yeah, I've got Hulu, yep.
Yeah, you can, if you do a search on it, write it down right now, Gallagher Effect. It's on a show called The Weekly. And it's one of the episodes on that. And I'll tell you, it's in my opinion, very well done, which leads me, that's kind of my segue into, you posted some stuff that you were reading about news and news reporting.
I did. It was an article from Bazaar that I have to give credit where credit's due. I stole that article from Jack Murphy, who was a journalist I used to work with, who recently changed the journalism jobs in a similar way that I am changing journalism jobs.
What's he doing? Just so, in case people don't know, Alex worships at the altar of Jack Murphy.
Jack Murphy's a great guy. Anybody who doesn't know, Jack Murphy's the reason why my name is on the byline just about anywhere. Once upon a time, I was writing uncredited work for those how-to sites that you see all over the web, you know. And there's no names on these articles, you know, but they're pretty labor-intensive. It was really – it's technical writing is what it is, and it tends to be kind of soul-sucking. And Jack Murphy and Desiree Hewitt, who was the managing editor of SoftRep at the time, decided to give me a shot to write one column for SoftRep years ago. That one column was about being in charge of funeral honor services for Marines for a few years, which is a job I did in Massachusetts for a long time. And the article did well. And so then they came back and asked if I'd be interested in doing something regularly. Before I knew it was two articles a week, then it was five. Then I'm an editor of the site, you know, and SoftRep has been my home for a long time. I'm actually leaving SoftRep tomorrow, finally, after about 4 years or so, to start a new job with a company called Sandbox that I'm very excited about. But Jack Murphy is the guy that very much gave me my break. But he's also the guy that in a lot of ways served as my mentor when I was a writer when I started working at SoftRep, but I certainly wasn't a journalist, you know? And Jack Murphy, I would argue, really took independent journalism to where it belonged in the military sphere before a lot of other people did, you know? Jack Murphy was doing it back in 2012 when it wasn't a very common thing to find on the internet. And I can't overstate how good it was an opportunity for me to get to work under Jack Murphy for a while. He now works for a company called Connecting Vets, doing stories that benefit the veteran community in a similar fashion to me going to Sandbox to work on things that benefit the active duty community. But Jack shared this story, which was actually written by a guy named Greg Jackson. And the story's called Vicious Cycles, and it's about the philosophy behind news. And basically the premise is that our news system is broken. It's broken so deeply and so systemically that it's really having a negative effect on how we carry out our democracy. But I don't mean that in the way that, you know, the news has got a lot of bias that it never used to have. The news has always had a lot of bias. The problem is that today we, as the audience, see the news as entertainment. You know, we get off on the outrage. We seek this conflict. We're constantly looking for things to be upset about and things to be angry about and ways to vilify the opposing side. But what this article really talks about, the article is called Vicious Cycles, Thesis on the Philosophy of News. The real crux of it is basically that the news is kind of built on a lie, because whether anything really significant happens today or not, as a news outlet, you've got to sensationalize whatever did occur today so that we can get people to keep clicking or keep viewing or keep reading. And as a result, we've created a system of bullshit. These things where, for instance, you know, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one of a young congresswoman that's made a lot of headlines because of her pursuit of this Green New Deal. But most of the headlines that you see pertaining to that are about one person just saying something about what it could mean, and then another person making a counterstatement about what it could mean. Very little actually occurs. But we are so engrossed in the soap opera, in the drama of these people talking about each other, talking at one another, when nothing's actually occurring, that we're creating this reverberating outrage echo, whether there's news or not. And the quote that I really loved out of it was, paraphrasing, until the news is willing to say, nothing of real import happened today, so we don't have a show or we don't have a copy, then the monument to truth that is the news will always be built on a lie. Because that lie is Whoa. That no matter what, we're going to shove something down your throat and try to make you feel as though it is the end of the world. No matter what, it could be the greatest day in history. We're going to find something. We'll say, you guys will notice this a lot in headlines that say things like, may happen, blank, 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 could lead to, blank, blank, blank. These are non-stories. These are hypotheses. This is a hypothesis being presented to you in the form of news. Anytime you see, this happens, so maybe this could happen. What you're being sold is maybe an outrage, maybe a fear. It's usually one or the other, outrage or fear or a combination of the two. And until we as an audience, until the news as an industry is able to say, you know what, it's not that big a deal that this person had a press conference just to say something inflammatory. Until we're in that position, which I'm not sure we'll ever be, the news is going to be operating not just at a disadvantage in terms of ideals, but the news is kind of hurting our greater dialogue. It hurts me to say it because as a news journalist, I want to say that my analysis is the important analysis. Other guys' analysis isn't as important. But the truth is we built this structure where your everyday person isn't able to be well-informed enough about all of the crap that's circling the drain all the time to form their own beliefs. So instead, we lump our beliefs into groups, into ideologies, and then we have other people establish our arguments for us. And every time you or someone you know says, well, I read an article recently, I saw a study that said, you're kind of participating in that ecosystem of being, we're not informed well enough at all times to form our own belief structure on the really important issues that are going on. So instead, we look to people to form our beliefs for us. We look to people to tell us where we stand on the climate change debate, because people in my political party tend to lean this way. Conservatives tend to say that the climate change science, you know, these people who believe in climate change aren't telling the truth, whereas liberals tend to say that the scientists are telling the truth, when in reality, neither is intrinsic to a political belief or party. It's really just kind of groupthink. And it's a really, really valuable article. I highly recommend you check it out. It's on harpers.org. Or you can check out my Facebook page, facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter. It's one of the more recent links I shared. I really recommend everyone read it. It's long, but it really explains a lot about why there's so much anxiety in the news industry today, why you keep seeing layoffs. It's because the news industry is rebuilding itself around this model that we as an audience are forcing on it. And that model is outrage, fear, and bullshit.
Which all drives profit.
It's far more profitable, which this is my huge fear. You know, now that I'm starting this new job with Sandbox, where my goal is to create a really positive outlet for military voices, I want families, I want active duty service members to be able to go to this website to get pertinent information. But I want their moms to be able to go to this website without seeing a laundry list of all the horrible things that pertain to being in service to the United States of America. There are some real challenges. There are some difficult things, and there are people doing great work covering that. But what I want to do is make a place that you can go without getting an anxiety attack, where you can really learn about the nobility of the effort. But I have that fear in the back of my head where I go, the thing that really sells, though, is the opposite of good feelings. You know, the thing that really sells is outrage and controversy. That's how you really make a splash on the internet today. I really hope that we can be a voice in opposition to that. I really hope that we can find an audience.
Well, let me tell you what you have to have. What you have to have is the money to do it for years and create that, right? You have to.
Absolutely.
You have to have the financial commitment from backers who see quality, and then you got to create traffic. Now, let me ask you this, creating traffic. You lectured us. Lecture's the wrong word, but you've educated us on.
Lecture's probably the right word.
On the on the necessity of clickbait.
Now, when I say necessity, I mean the economic necessity
of
clickbait.
Well, we're talking. Look, you know, if you want to be viable, right, you have to.
It really is true. It doesn't mean that you need to produce clickbait, but it does mean that you have to be cognizant of clickbait. And what I mean by that is, see, I look at content strategies as a promise, right? So your headline and your feature image is actually what dictates your traffic. The quality of your work has very little to do with how many people will see it. The content of your work even has not as much to do with how many people will see it as much as that headline and that feature photo, which is how clickbait was really born. The idea behind clickbait is that they make you a promise with a crazy picture and a crazy headline that when you click on this, you're going to see something that's really worth your time. The idea is, it's the same premise as when you were in middle school and somebody came running up and said, I know a girl who has a crush on you. They said that to you only because they wanted you to chase them asking who, right? That's what clickbait is. They say, you'll never believe what happens next. They're making you a promise that you're going to see something awesome in the literary way, worthy of awe, right? Then you click on it and it's bullshit. That's clickbait. What clickbait is it's a trick. It's a
broken
promise.
You mean she really didn't like me?
Right? No, she may well have liked you, but there might have been the ugly girl telling you
that
someone had a crush on you. And then it's a bad day, right? That's what clickbait is, right? Clickbait is when they make you a promise and then they break that promise. And the way that we usually measure that when you're running a news website, or really most any website, is with a metric called the bounce rate. The bounce rate is how many people click on your site, see it and go, oh, this is garbage, and click away, right? If they don't look at anything else, they don't spend a great deal of time on your site, they just go, they click in and then they back out. This is garbage. That's your bounce rate. A lot of news sites have relatively high bounce rates just because people are only interested in one story today. But still, a really high bounce rate is a good indicator that the content you're producing is garbage, that you're breaking your promise to the readers. Bounce rate, however, is not the number one metric that people use to gauge a site's success. That's why you see so much clickbait out there. Traffic in is the biggest, right? Everybody wants to know, how many people see your site so they know how many people could potentially see their ads on your site. So that's why bounce rate is only really worried about for really savvy advertisers, right? Clickbait does have drawbacks, your high bounce rate being one of them, but that's really it. Other than that, it really benefits these companies to trick you. It's very profitable to trick you into clicking on stuff. Now, if you're a good outlet, you're still going to utilize some of that clickbait practices, some of those clickbait practices in your headlining and in your feature photos, because just like anyone else, your revenue is based on traffic, right? So a great example that I could give that people that are listening to this show will probably be familiar with was the Marines United scandal from last year, right? The Marines United scandal was all about a group of Marine veterans that were shitheads and were exchanging nude photos of female service members without their knowledge in this secret Facebook group, right? They were exchanging people's nude pictures without their permission. When that story broke, a lot of major news outlets, a lot of independent news outlets, used provocative photos of female service members to sell those stories. The feature image under the headline about bad Marines sharing pictures of women was usually a feature image of a female service member bearing midriff with her head chopped out of the photo or blurred out, things like that. In my mind, that is a real lapse in ethics, right? But in terms of traffic, I can tell you, because I saw some of the numbers, the articles that used images like that did significantly better than the articles that just showed a picture of, let's say, a group of female Marines in a formation in full uniform, or a group of Marines with co-ed genders dispersed throughout the formation.
Or a picture of a female Marine, like, obviously distraught, right?
Upset.
Telling a story is not going to get you what the... Right.
No, but a belly button and some underboob sure as hell will. It'll get this picture trending in a heartbeat, or we'll get the story trending in a heartbeat. Now, I understand that the inclination is to blame the outlet for that, but when you're the outlet and you see these clickbait sites, a lot of sites are content farmers. What they'll do is they literally copy and paste stories from other websites without attribution. It's really difficult to take them to task for that. So what you really end up seeing is you see these click farms producing content like that, and if you want to compete as CNN, if you want to compete as an independent news outlet, you need your pictures, your headline, to be just as scathing as the next guy. So you can absolutely say, well, who started it? It's not really about who started it. It's not even really about who's continuing it. It's about us as an audience perpetuating it. We're voting with our clicks, and we're voting for really shitty stuff. I know it sounded like a campaign platform. Maybe it should.
No, but again, it's a huge challenge, right? To try to do content without that, you know, and move away from that model. And you have to have the people that back it understand that, you know, because everybody wants to see this thing get big, right? We want to see it go ba-boom, and we're hiring these bigger people, you know. But there's a quotient for ba-boom, and it's not. It's not quality content. It is.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in you can grow really quickly, but it's challenging and difficult, right? When you grow faster than your infrastructure is able to support, things tend to go badly, right? But I do think that there's two ways to grow in the digital media industry. One is through controversy, right? You can get a really large following by picking a side of some really hot topic debate, and then making yourself a clear voice in support or opposition of that issue. It's a really good way to get a lot of traction. The problem is that it makes you a very polarizing figure, right? And as soon as you're – look at that 16-year-old girl, Greta Thunberg, right?
Right.
She gained a lot of notoriety through conflict, right? Her notoriety isn't really based on the fact that she's saying things that climate change activists agree with. Her notoriety is based on she's saying things climate change deniers don't agree with. Her celebrity is built very much on the controversy that surrounds her, more so than what she's actually saying. The stuff she's saying is stuff lots of people have said before. It's the controversy that surrounds her that makes her famous. We created her as a celebrity because of our drive for controversy, for outrage. We want to either be outraged at her for what she's saying, or we want to be outraged at her opposition for what they're saying to her. It's outrage-driven, not change-driven. I don't think that she is actually having the effect on people that her intent would be. I think instead that's become secondary to her celebrity.
Right.
And that's on us, not on her.
Well, no, and that's the way that is the way it works now. I mean, it is not about the truth and the intellectual content of her argument. It is why is that girl? Why is she this international phenomenon, though?
You know, exactly.
I mean, her argument has been around forever.
The more we make it about her, the further we get from whatever it was that she was trying to convey, right? So even those outlets that you would assume agree with her, right, left-leaning outlets or just outlets that have got a really strong understanding of climate science, those people who say, hey, there's something to some of this, even them focus instead on her, on what she was saying on this train ride, or whether or not she can get a yacht ride to the next thing, or whether or not she'll ever ride an airplane again, what she said when she was off the cuff remarks this time. It's all about whether or not we should be trusting or liking this, I mean, kid. She's a kid, you know? Instead of being about, hey, what the hell is she talking about?
Well, and really, what happens is, right, to me, what the internet does now with this, and you know, it's really interesting because over the weekend here, last few days, I finished night before last, I watched this series on Amazon Prime called The Man Who Made America or something like that. I can't remember. Amazon Prime Video. Hold on. I'll give you. Let me. Oh, man. It was about Vanderbilt, Carnegie.
Oh, I believe it was a History Channel series. Was it kind of like a really cool stylized, like, narrative?
Historical drama, blah, blah, blah. But it starts with Vanderbilt and how he starts with boats and then moves to railroads. And then it starts with, and then it goes to Rockefeller. And I learned, you know, and I'm a student of economics, but I didn't know their stories as well as I probably wished I would have. And, you know, Rockefeller, he gets his start, right, trying to take this product, kerosene, and make it for universal use. And then the railroads try to jack him. Vanderbilt's one of the guys who tries to jack him, and he says, no, I'm not having that. I'll shut down a bunch of refineries. I'll consolidate, and I'll build my own pipelines, and I won't need you, and I'll drive you into the dirt. So it's like they had this gigantic competition. And then Carnegie is the understudy of one of the guys who tries to shake down Rockefeller. Carnegie is like the young protege. Carnegie's job is to bridge the Mississippi River, because whoever bridges the Mississippi River and owns that bridge will make an incredible amount of money, because they will shorten the timeline for transportation and the cumbersome nature of transportation, where you got to train to the river, and then you got to offload, and then you got to ferry, and then you got to unload. You'll cut all that out, and then so you'll be able to jack people for all this money. But anyway, so that's Carnegie. That's how Carnegie finds steel, because lead is too heavy to do it. And so you're like, I didn't know that. And so then you have Carnegie's life and the growth of steel. And then you have Ford comes out on the tail end of that. And then you have J.P. Morgan. And so I was thinking about that, and you think, okay, those tectonic plates continue in today's digital age. Amazon is one of them. Google, Facebook, right?
Amazon's a great example, because Amazon recently was shaking down book publishers for book pricing, because Amazon is very quickly making itself the only game in town for buying books. You know, Verizon, another good example, when Verizon was renegotiating its deal with Netflix, they turned the bandwidth down on Netflix to make Netflix slower for Netflix subscribers that go through Verizon. So that they ran the risk of losing subscribers, Netflix did, because the people who were subscribing to their service were getting long buffering times in their videos, because Verizon, much like, you know, you're talking about with steel, Verizon literally was able to effectively do the same thing. Instead of saying we won't carry your gas, your kerosene on trains, they're saying we won't carry your content on our fiber wires. You know,
right?
And the same practices of making a billionaire exist today.
Right, and so you look at that, and then you look at a guy like Theodore Roosevelt, right, who wouldn't play their game, and Roosevelt, they effectively off ramp Roosevelt into the vice president's job, so he's not the governor of the state of New York, right? He's not the president of the United States, right? He's the vice president, and then McKinley gets assassinated, and then things like the 8-hour workday. Right, the trust busting that Roosevelt does, and to me, Roosevelt's a greater president than he gets credit for because of the nature of his far-reaching reforms relative to the economy, and these guys who were kind of like what Amazon, what Google and Facebook, they're operating in an unregulated realm.
And yeah, we're creating this generation's steel barons, the digital barons.
Exactly. And at some point, there's got to be a Roosevelt that comes and steps in and says, no, children can't work. And there should be an 8-hour workday. And Ford is one of those guys who comes on the tail end of those guys when their kind of unbridled reign is over. And Ford says, I'm going to make a car that anybody in this country can afford, not just
and
the
I'm going to make a 5-day work week.
So I'm a 5-day work week, 8-hour work day. I'm going to pay people real money. And Ford changes the landscape of manufacturing, right? And so to me, it was I love watching stuff like that. And because you see how a lot of the innovation that's driven in, I'll tell you, another fascinating part of this series is J.P. Morgan, who's the son of Junius Morgan, who creates the House of Morgan, you know, the financial, don't ever get caught with your money at risk. What your job is to do is create this gigantic financial machine that makes money off the buy and the sell. You're never at risk, okay? His son, J.P. Morgan, he's like, yeah, whatever. And he sees Edison's electricity. Edison's electricity, though, is not what the country embraces. The country embraces Tesla's, right?
DC current.
DC current, right? Or AC
Tesla
current.
Tesla alternating current.
Yeah, he was
Tesla
AC.
Tesla was alternating current.
Alternating current, right? So he was AC. And so ultimately the way Morgan gets control after he loses the competition is he runs Westinghouse out of business. And he buys the patent that owns Tesla's work, because Tesla drew up his contract that said, I won't hold any claim to it, so you can use that to get more money to leverage this thing. Well, Morgan then buys it, and he owes Tesla nothing, and Tesla dies, penniless guy.
A virgin.
Exactly. And so you watch this stuff, and it's just fascinating, like the story of electricity, and guys who saw it, and they peered over, but it was completely unregulated. Completely.
And we really did. We've lived through this boom, right? You know, we've watched the internet become this same giant machine.
Well, and again, what you're talking about
is that our lawmakers don't understand it well enough to regulate it in any effective way.
And how do you, when the news industry that you used to pick up and you read the front page stories written by professional journalists who we all assumed wrote the truth, and then you had the local section, you had the classified ads. Then you peel back.
I mean,
back.
We all assumed it was the truth, but bias was there.
Right. I agree. I don't know to the extent it is today, but we could argue that.
I mean, the very first newspapers in the United States were very partisan. Public Occurrences was very, very partisan. It wasn't honestly until like the 1800s that objective journalism became something that we even tried or aspired for.
But
it wasn't until after the era of yellow journalism that we started going, hey, maybe we should start looking for journalists that tell the truth. But that wasn't an intrinsic part of the media until fairly recently. I know it's a crazy thing to think
about. No. But I mean, so when you peel back through the newspaper, then you got to the opinion sections. You had the op-ed, you had the editorials, you had the letters to the editor.
Which I think that's a big deal, is that we no longer separate them.
Right. And that, to me, is the whole entertainment value. You don't have... So somebody on TV is not introduced anymore as our reporter at the White House. It's our correspondent at the White House. Why do they do that? Because reporter, in terms of journalism, has a very specific meaning. And you'll see professional reporters that come on TV, and they're very clipped, and they're very disciplined about what they say.
Well, they speak in snippets because they have to, you know, number
right.
one.
Because they're reporters, and they believe exactly. in that. But I would tell you it's harder to make a living that way. It's easier to make a living as a correspondent because you can bloviate, you can sensationalize, and you can make more money.
And, I mean, that's what most of the news is today. That's the important thing for people. There's two things that support that I want to bring up. The first is that there was a study conducted, I want to say 18 months ago, a year and a half or so ago, that was of, you know, I think it was 4,000 or 5,000 people, where they just showed them different headlines and asked them to choose which headline was clearly a subjective headline, was clearly an opinion, and which headline was an objective basis of fact, right? And your average American cannot differentiate between a headline that suggests that this is an opinion and a headline that suggests that it's just recounting facts. You know, if a headline says Donald Trump does something terrible, that is an opinion. That is not an objective statement of facts. If the headline said Donald Trump did a specific thing that you may consider to be terrible, that's a headline. That's an objective statement of fact. So because Americans aren't able to differentiate between fact and opinion at a high rate at this point, in part because headlines are intentionally written in a misleading way to get you to click, right? If we're not able to differentiate between an op-ed and a hard news piece, and these news outlets don't want you to differentiate between an op-ed and a hard news piece. This also stays true for television news, because if you watch Fox News, a lot of their news is actually commentary and opinion news. It's analysis news. You're creating ideologies as opposed to just informing, right? Same thing with CNN and all the other big dogs. The idea is that we've blurred the lines between an objective telling of news, like the Dan Rather news, and our analysis or our subjective opinion on it. And I'd like to quote this piece because this piece speaks directly to that. The one we're talking about in Harper's by I'm going to scroll back up to see his name here. By Greg Jackson. But he touches on this concept specifically, and he says, one way to tell you're in the presence of ideology is when an entire industry of opinion exists to bolster and substantiate beliefs that people do not know how to justify on their own. And that's exactly what we're talking about. We've created an entire ecosystem of news outlets that blur the line between opinion and fact so that they can help you establish and confirm your beliefs, right? Your ideologies. And I don't want to say this to you as though you're dumb. The audience is not dumb. We're all susceptible to this. It's the same premise as advertising. You know, advertising, we all know, works. If advertising didn't work, it wouldn't be one of the biggest industries in the United States. Advertising works. Bias in media works in very much the same ways. It's not always intentional. Sometimes it's subconscious bias, but all of that bias seeps into the way you frame a story in your mind. It shapes the window. It colors the window pane so that when you look through that window into the world, which is your phone or your computer or your television or your radio, when you're looking through that window, you're seeing the world through that outlet's colored glasses. And it's important that we recognize that, because today, the thing that I do believe has changed dramatically is that we no longer act as though there's a difference between hard news and op-eds. Now we pretend that it's all the same thing. And if you go on CNN.com right now, I promise you that you will find subjective language in every story on their front page. CNN knows that they're catering to a liberally biased audience. Fox News knows that they're catering to a conservatively biased audience. So you'll find subjective language permeating through all of their work, not just the op-eds. That's this dangerous change that we've seen. But the reason is, as we were saying earlier, because it's that subjective slant that sells. Otherwise, all you're doing is reporting on the same thing 60 other people are. But if you can give it that angle, that sexy angle about Donald Trump being either a villain or a hero, you're going to get a lot more people to click. And that's why even normal hard news pieces read sort of like op-eds now. They read like persuasive essays that we all wrote in grade school. You remember those five-paragraph persuasive essays? That's become status quo for a lot of news. Whether there's a teleprompter or a computer screen that's got it written on, it's still the same.
So to me, when I was watching that series, one of the things that occurred to me is, okay, so at what point do we rewrite the ship? One of the things that Roosevelt observed was the polarization of money in the country, that there wasn't this middle class. It was the haves and have-nots. It was the guys working the steel mills, 10%. You know, of the workforce suffered some sort of either disability or death annually in steel mills. But you were happy to be employed and have a job, and you lived, you know, a not too great life. And so to me, I don't know that we're at that same place, but through treaties like NAFTA, where you export your manufacturing, okay, which destroys the middle class, okay? Those were union jobs that supported families. So if you're not able to recreate those jobs, if you've outsourced your agriculture and put your farmers out of business and all the people that transported, you know, grain and all the things they do. So to me, then you have to change, because what has sustained the United States is the great middle class. So if the service sector is now the job in the country, then that's got to pay a living wage. It's got to have health care. It's got to have a retirement, right?
No, especially because, I mean, and this is the reason why you see the growth of the gig economy, right? And something that a lot of people don't realize is that you have a higher likelihood of being employed primarily through the gig economy with a master's degree than you are with a bachelor's degree.
Right.
The higher education you have, the less likely you are in the United States today to have sustained, stable employment. You know, so we're seeing it's crushing the middle class in two ways. It's crushing the blue collar side of the middle class, but also the portion of the middle class from my generation that was raised under the premise that you needed a degree to be anything. You know, we grew up being told that you have to go to college. We were probably the first generation that grew up being told that you have to go to college to make something of yourself. So a lot of people from my generation went to college for their interests, which really was just a route to crippling debt and unemployment, right? If you go and major in underwater basket weaving or theatrical lighting, you're not going to get a great job in Wisconsin, right? I guarantee you'll find a school that will give you a diploma in it in Wisconsin.
Right.
But that doesn't benefit the economy as a whole. So we grew up chasing diplomas as opposed to chasing employment, with this understanding that there should be a six-figure job at the under end of the certificate,
right,
for us.
That would in fact be the case. And I'll tell you what, to me, you want to know a route that you ought to take, if you want to live a good life, if you want to own your own business, go into the trades.
Become a plumber, become an AC guy,
right.
Become a welder.
Right.
And really become a carpenter. These are all positions that, I'll tell you right now, if you decide to go, I have 2 degrees in communications, bachelor's and master's, right? And I promise you right now that if instead of you spending the 6 years that I spent collecting those diplomas, if you instead spent 6 years working towards becoming a master electrician, working as an electrician's apprentice, and working your way through. In those same 6 years, you will come out on the other end making significantly more money than I did when I first finished my master's degree. I promise you that.
Yeah. it's a fact. And you will have sustained work. You'll be insulated from the ups and downs of the economy, because people always need plumbers. They always need electricians.
And it turns out people don't always need academics bloviating at them about politics.
How about
I just
that?
Hope they'll keep wanting me to do it.
How about that? Well, to me, there's a reconciliation in the academics that are coming, that if the demand for that product slackens, right, and then and that sector begins to contract a little on the margins, right, the ripple effect of that will be huge, because we have done so much to sustain academic communities when the economy is not so much about what they contribute. And so to me, I think that there's a contraction coming in higher ed.
I worry about what the economy is going to look like I mean, I don't want to put too much wind in Andrew Yang's sails, but that combination of that and automation, I think, is going to create unemployment concerns in the future. I think that we will bounce back. We're going to recover the same way we did with the Industrial Revolution, and the way that we went about working changed. The way we go about working will have to change again. But change hurts, man. Change oftentimes comes at the expense of many individuals. So even though, as a society, I'm certain that we will continue to thrive.
Well, and again, I worry about it. You have to look at monopolies like Amazon controls 80% of the online retail traffic in this country. That's a good thing. Google controls whatever amount of the search traffic in this country. That's a good thing. And so you look at that and say, you know, we've been down this road in our history before, right? And also what's interesting is the concentration of wealth in our country. Is that similar to it was, you know, adjusted for inflation, you know, 100 years ago? Or is it different?
I think it's important that we talk about that, even though this has happened historically, and we've seen it happen before. I can't remember the exact language James Mattis used, but he was talking about in conflict. He's like, the United States has no ordained right to victory.
Yeah.
You know, and the United States has no ordained right to economic victory either. Even though we've made it through similar challenges before, it doesn't mean that we don't need to really leverage everything we can to help make sure that our economy stays vital through this really significant change, right? Just because we've done it before doesn't guarantee that we can do it again. We really have to put our nose to the grindstone and make our economy work if our economy is going to work. Otherwise, I mean, it seems unfathomable for us to end up as bad off as a country like Russia or even worse. But the fact of the matter is that historical precedent says that we will eventually.
Well, right? And again, it's about the maintenance of the American dream, that the American dream is supposed to be available to everybody. And how do you ensure that? And if the underlying economy has changed, then you've got to change some of the other things in the economy to adjust to that. And if you don't, then you just allow people to exploit other people, especially people that have a lot of capital.
Right. And especially in this exploitative system, if you're not willing to be the guy that plants a tree that you'll never get to sit in the shade of, then we're going to be in trouble. We need people who have that mentality, where they're genuinely trying to develop a prosperous future, as opposed to just wringing every penny out of today. And that's a tough thing to ask corporations to do.
Yeah, normally, and they normally suck at it. So that's why we have a legal system. When and where are we going to read you next?
Well, tomorrow is my last day as a staff writer and editor for SoftRep.com. So, I mean, my stories will still be trickling out, as well as I have over 3,000 articles I've written for SoftRep over the years. So they have a huge back catalog of my work. So you'll still be seeing my name pop up on their site, I'm sure, for a long time to come. You'll still be able to, you know, if you're a fan of my work, I promise you they've got stuff you haven't seen. If you're a SoftRep subscriber, you'll still get to read some stuff from me. But as of tomorrow, my full-time job is going to be working at Sandbox, which is a really great company that was founded on the premise of making it easier to send correspondence and care packages to service members in training and in theater, right? So now every Marine who goes to boot camp gets a Sandbox account as part of their in-doc, as part of their in-brief. And that Sandbox account makes it so that their parents or other family members can, I mean, you can even literally on your phone text Sandbox, and they will print it out into a letter, stamp it, and deliver it the following day. So that's what they were built on. Over the last year, a woman named Nicole Utz, who's their head of marketing, has been running a blog on their website that's primarily populated with content from service member spouses. There's a staff of three service member spouses that have been writing content kind of aimed at service member families. The site, the blog, has done very, very well. You know, they had over 1 million people come and check it out last year.
Wow.
So they decided that they want to double down on this and invest in making it a real digital destination, not just for families, but for service members themselves. And I was fortunate enough that they recruited me to head up this initiative. So starting on the 1st of January, I will be writing daily on Sandbox. You can find their website at sandbox.us. It's Sandbox with two X's. Or you can just literally Google Sandbox with two X's and you'll find it. I'll be writing content every day for Sandbox. I'm also serving as the editor for all of the other writers. I've got a staff of people that I'll be writing content. Some of it more aimed towards families, some of it more aimed towards veterans, and some of it more aimed towards active duty service members. But as I was saying before, my goal is to really build on the positive environment they've kind of already cultivated and try to grow that into what is kind of an aggressive environment. You know, service members and veterans, we tend to eat our own. We can be really competitive. We tear each other down as much as we build each other up. My goal, and Sandbox has been great about helping me establish this goal, is to create a website that you can go to think about, to talk about, to look at, and discuss the great things that our service members are doing, the great things that our service members' families are doing, and kind of participate in that culture without all of the bullshit, without the drama and the soap opera and the politics. I really want to create a place that you can go that won't ruin your day. And that's what Sandbox's website's going to be. I couldn't be more excited about getting to build it. I couldn't be more excited about the team. It's founded by a former Marine sergeant and a retired general. Most of my coworkers that I've worked with are Marine spouses. Nicole, as I mentioned earlier, her husband's a Marine who's currently deployed on a MU. So it's really a company that gives a shit. It's a company that really cares about the audience because we are the audience. You know, I couldn't be more excited. I really recommend people check it out. Sandbox with two X's, SANDBOXX.US. Click on the blog. You'll see all the content that's already been written by their great staff of writers. And starting the day after tomorrow, you'll see daily stuff from me as well.
There you have it. Alex Hollings. Dude, good luck. Thank you. We'll talk to you.
Thanks, man. I can't wait. I'll talk to you next year.
Dad
jokes.
I know. Sucks. Anyway, see you. Alex Hollings here. On a Monday. That'll do it. If you're just tuning in, hour one, pretty interesting. You're going to hear audio from the interviews that were done with United States Navy SEALs. I would encourage you to watch a feature called The Weekly. It's produced by the New York Times. It airs through the New York Times, which you may or may not have to pay to watch. So you might find it there. You can find it on Hulu right now and watch it there. So you're going to hear audio from that, from those interviews. The guy who does the feature, is featured in the feature, is a guy by the name of Dave Phillips. He's a national correspondent covering veterans and the military. He won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. Since joining the New York Times in 2014, he's covered the military community from the ground up, focusing largely on the unintended consequences of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So he's kind of the featured guy in it. He tells the story. And you're going to hear that. It's incredibly interesting, and it's as close as I've seen to what I would tell you is the truth. Right, and that is that you had between 7 and 12 SEALs that were incredibly disturbed by the murders of Eddie Gallagher. And they came back and they demanded that there be an investigation, demanded that there be an investigation. And then after he was charged and threatened them, and then he was incarcerated, right, by what was presented to a judge in terms of the text messages that he was sending, right? The defense finds a friend in Fox News, and they get national coverage of Gallagher as a victim. They get a corpsman who's granted immunity to lie and say that I'm the one that killed this kid. Right, and you see the video of Gallagher with not the still picture. You see video of him jumping down and checking out this young, he looks to be a teenager, you know, maybe 16 or 17, and he's semi-conscious. He's got a leg wound. And so anyway, you see him jump down and begin to treat the kid and check out his wound. And then whoever's videoing this shuts their helmet camera off. Kind of interesting. Why would you shut it off? But anyway, you'll hear that. And so don't touch that dial. So on a Monday, Bob Nielsen will join us tomorrow as kind of head our way through the new year. Have a great day on a Monday on Marine Radio, over and out.